This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark, brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
Good to be here.
Hey, guys.
So, these Andrew Yang memes, they're basically everywhere on Twitter now, and basically, he is the candidate, and basically everyone that we associate with is backing him now. And, Brandon, the last time you were on the show, we discussed Tulsi Gabbard. So, you never really supported Bernie Sanders, but you were initially a Tulsi Gabbard supporter.
Yeah, I was. I mean, I think that in a different election, like, she would probably be the best candidate. But I think that, like, when Bernie entered the race, it pretty much just wiped out her chances, because that's kind of, like, a very similar demographic to hers, whereas I think Yang has this kind of more, like, has some of that appeal, but has like a much broader, more unconventional appeal.
He's even more of an outsider, and it seems as if he's bringing an even more kind of novel coalition together and kind of fusing some different things in an interesting way that Tulsi does a little bit, but he does it in a more radical way.
Yeah, her primary issue is, yeah, foreign policies are focused, combined with some of the economic issues of Bernie Sanders. I would actually say this election, Bernie Sanders is less anti-establishment than he was last election, and there actually are parallels. I mean, I think, I wouldn't say Bernie Sanders has not sold out to the degree that Trump has, but there definitely are parallels between Trump and Sanders. So Bernie is less anti-establishment than he was last election. So basically, taking up social justice and establishment talking points. Andrew Yang is the anti-establishment candidate of this election.
Right. What it kind of reminds me of is how when Ron Paul ran the second time in 2012, like, he had kind of toned down a lot of the stuff that had made him popular in 2008 as, like, an anti-establishment candidate. You remember they suddenly, like, he was no longer really talked about immigration and that kind of stuff. It was just all about, like, the gold standard and that sort of thing.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
So when he ran the second time. And I don't know, but, like, Bernie, to me, he's proven that he's, like, he's very easily, like, bullied into backing the establishment thing. I mean, he even, like, both him and Tulsi fell for that, like, Jussie Smollett hoax and entry. It was just, like, embarrassing. And also, like, he increasingly just doesn't, Bernie doesn't have anything really interesting to say. Anyway, it's just kind of, like, it's just the basic, like, and he's been willing to even, like, go against his own prior beliefs if it's like, if he can score points on Trump, like, even if it's something he used to, like, agree with, that he, like, uses it to attack Trump, like, in terms of foreign policy and that kind of thing. So, yeah, I think he's just proven that he's very easily bullied, and he just doesn't really seem all that interesting, to be honest. Like, he doesn't represent radical change the way he might have not just 4 years ago, but maybe like 10 or 20 years ago.
And what is interesting about the whole Yang movement is basically it's a big tent movement of radical centrist, neo-reactionaries, Bernie bros, and leftist. And it'll be interesting to see if all those different groups tolerate each other.
Well, they don't really have a choice, because ultimately there's already been things where, like, well, you know, these people have no place in this movement or this campaign, but like, tough shit, you know, you can't do anything about it. So his Yang's policies are going to appeal to really a broad range of Americans, and like, there's nothing you can do about this. You just have to relax and deal with it. But I think it's kind of amazing just that people just need to embrace the fact that Yang is really the only candidate who can unify all of these all these insane different groups of people that would otherwise just absolutely hate each other. And people should just, like, deal with that.
Yeah, and embrace it. I mean, I don't really anticipate that being a huge issue with Yang's campaign, because it has this kind of trickle-up phenomenon where it's a lot of, I think, people kind of discovering his candidacy sort of independently and then just kind of memeing about it, and it creates this totally novel sort of movement. So I don't really anticipate the differences between different factions of his support clashing being a big issue. I kind of see him, that's one leg up that he kind of has on Tulsi, is he's less kind of, he's less clearly like, you know, in with the whole SJW thing. He kind of does come across like he really is cutting through the mire of a lot of culture war stuff in a way that Bernie and Tulsi don't quite.
Yeah, he's basically the only non-SJW candidate on the Democratic side. Even Tulsi Gabbard, I like Tulsi Gabbard in a lot of ways, but she still panders to that crowd.
The thing is Yang is totally, like, a part of that SJW crowd. But, I mean, he's paying people $1,000 a month, you know? Like, I'm willing to put up with that kind of bullshit if I'm getting $1,000, you know, in meat bucks every month, and I can sit around and play Kid Icarus all day. Like, that's fine, man. He can talk about, like, you know, he can talk about, like, I don't know, government-funded, you know, transgendered preschool or something like that. I don't give a fuck. Like, it's just, you know, I don't really care. I'm not, in terms of Yang, you know, like, I'm not a social conservative really anyway at all. So, like, the people that complain about that he's, you know, for the, like, oh, look at what his policy on this is or that is. It's like, I'm like, well, I'm cool with most of that stuff, so I don't really care. And, I think he is totally on board with that stuff. He's already made, like, denunciations of, like, alt-right people supporting his candidacy and questionable memes and that kind of thing. He says, I don't want their support, blah, blah, blah. But it's like, well, yeah, tough shit. You know, you're going to pay us $1,000 a month, so we're going to support you, like, whether you like it or not.
At the same time, I mean, I haven't heard him talk as much as I'd like to, actually. I want to do more research on him, but my impression is, while he's clearly liberal in some real sense, he's willing to be a hard realist about things. He's willing to, you know, recognize that you know, working class white people in this country, that their issues are legitimate, and that's part of what goes into his UBI, his stance on UBI and his stance on automation. I guess all I'm trying to say is that no matter how liberal he is, and those are his values, at the same time, I really think he's a hard realist about the reality of demographic change and the effects it will have.
Right, and he also, rather than spending all his time, like, just pandering to these groups and giving these platitudes, like, he kind of bypasses all of that language and focuses strictly on, like, detailed solutions to these issues. So, like, that's, you know, he has a solutions-oriented approach. So rather than just, talking about social justice, pandering to these groups, like, he just puts forward these detailed policies that are going to actually address these issues in ways that benefit everyone. So it's like, he's on board with all of the social justice stuff, but what does it matter if the policies he's implementing are going to benefit everyone, then who cares?
His candidacy isn't so ideological. It's not based on these bullshit talking points. It's very, very policy-oriented. And, like, it's almost like no matter what your stance on all of his views are, it's like we can appreciate getting someone who's actually putting forward problem-solving type ideas rather than, you know, SJWism on the one hand or the America First Trump rhetoric, which is getting old too.
Yeah, most of the interviews Yang has done is very much focused on policy, and especially economic policy, because most candidates, major candidates, especially Trump, but even Bernie Sanders to a degree, everything is about these slogans and platitudes, and pretty much most of his interviews are focused on his proposal for a basic income. And Brandon, have you been an advocate and supporter of the basic income for quite some time?
Yeah, I mean, of course. We've talked about it on this show many times, of course, because we're also, I mean, both, you know, all three of us, I guess, we're all artists, so it has kind of a different meaning to people like us as opposed to maybe normies that just have this idea that, well, if you get 1,000, you're not going to have any purpose in life, and you're just going to sit around and eat junk food or whatever. Whereas for people like us, it has kind of a we're able to kind of more pursue our passions, you know, without like sitting in some shitty cubicle all day and wishing that you could be at home painting or something like that. You know what I mean? So I've always been a supporter of it because, yeah, I mean, I think working any job sucks ass, and Yang's what he understands is that, and this is where people sometimes go against him, if they're for more of these traditional solutions like limiting immigration or trade restrictions, like and automation taking jobs. Like, I think Yang recognizes that that those forces like are not going to be able to be stopped. Like, you're not going to be able to have the U.S. be competitive and like not technologically innovate, not become more efficient. So the answer to that then is to find these weirder, more kind of experimental solutions where, like, well, yeah, we won't stop these companies from automating. We'll just figure out a way to just give people money, since these, instead of just trying to fight this thing and become primitivists or something like that, we're just going to let these companies do their self-checkout and their robot manufacturing and all that, and instead we'll just give people money with the extra money that's being made with all of this new efficiency.
As far as the arts go, all three of us are artists, so we really understand that, and Yang addresses that directly on his platform, basically the need to fund the arts, and at very least to have a basic income will enable people to pursue their passions, which basically, this is why I really, all this conservative nonsense, like, basically if you want to be an artist or writer, you have to go out and get a real job, because you're not going to have time left over, and you're going to be tired, and you're going to be stressed out. And the other thing is, a lot of the people, there's people who are on maybe trust funds, or they have wealthy family who will sponsor them, and then those are the people who go on to be writers. So, yeah, I think it's really important for creative types to have a basic income, and Yang explicitly directs that. And that's why he's successful at building this growing big tent movement, because you have this, it unites all these different diverse demographics. Yeah, as far as the basic income goes, we're not going to stop automation, and you're going to have Luddites trying to pass laws limiting automation, but it's inevitable. And the thing is how to adapt to automation, because say you have someone making $50,000 a year, and the neat bucks they're going to get is $12,000 a year. So basically the basic income is a cushion. It takes the edge off of economic stress, and it gives you enough to survive, just to take care of your very basic needs, but it's not enough to really live on and live a good life. So it's a cushion, but it's not enough. But I still think it's very important to support this.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. I mean, in terms of the automation, I think, again, to call Yang a sort of realist candidate, I mean, I can definitely understand, like, sort of Luddite arguments to try and hold this stuff back. But I think, you know, I kind of have this deterministic view of history and technology in this way, where it's like you can try to push it back as much as you want, but eventually eventually these developments will happen. And I think that Yang is realistic about that.
Also, a basic income, it saves money on bureaucracy and on incarceration. And basically, Yang's position is to limit and to streamline a bureaucracy, basically limiting the size of government workforce. And in some ways, that's a more centrist or even a conservative position.
Yeah, it's like, I don't know all the details of his specific view of UBI, but it's almost like, you know, just making that very simple thing, give every person $1,000, and then you can actually make government smaller after that. So it doesn't fit clearly as like a form of socialism. It's a kind of radical centrism.
And also there's this concept of trickle-up economics, because if everyone has an extra $1,000, then they're going to be spending a lot of that in their local economy, and it will contribute to a lot of entrepreneurship. And that's a very important thing, because Trump is basically promoting a failed trickle-down economics, which had been tried by Republicans in the past since Reagan, and trickle-down economics obviously failed, but the whole concept of trickle-up economics, because also it would decentralize the spread of wealth. So with trickle-down economics or Reaganomics, wealth gets too concentrated in the hands of a few, but pumping in a lot of money into the, basically how the welfare state in its current form is not, that's not really effective in distributing wealth either, because there's a lot of problems with that, including the bureaucratic element. But with the basic income, it will have a much more even spread across the nation, because everyone will get an equal amount.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And, you know, think how many copies of Journey to Vapor Island you could stockpile if you got with $1,000 a month. And be like,
yeah.
No, I think about that kind of thing, because I like to mail out books and things to market it, so that I could send out like, you know, 300 or 400 copies a month. I could mail out, like, it's much easier than
good culturally, or potentially so good culturally. I mean, I think this issue of us being artists and that and having a certain perspective on UBI because of that is very interesting. And it kind of reminds me, it ties into, I believe, the last show you posted, Robert, with Bay Area guy on Dave Graber's book, Bullshit Jobs, about how every, you know, our work culture is so kind of just this emphasis on, you know, you need to work in order to find meaning is kind of a...
And also that brings up an interesting point, because you always hear people claim that being an artist or something is like a bullshit job. Well, meanwhile, they're like in the cubicle selling like overpriced like social media marketing packages that like
have absolutely no value at all.
And also with conservatives, they have this idea that it's like, well, you know, that you have to like make a lot of money as an artist or something for it to matter or something like that. But that's not necessarily how art works. And a lot of the people who are like well-known artists, a lot of them are just like trust fund kids that simply have the time to do all this stuff. It's either you're a trust fund kid, or you just like have absolutely nothing and you can just barely just find a way to live and scrape by. So it's kind of you know, this idea of like that the market like solves everything, or the market determines like what is good, like, you know, that's like saying that Justin Bieber makes $50 million out of that, you know, whereas like some other musician or something could be much more interesting or something like that.
Yeah,
but no. according to conservative like ideals, that means that like Katy Perry is the best, which is actually kind of like ironic if you think about it, because they would be the first ones to say that like all of these famous like social justice celebs are like idiots and like awful people, but yet according to their
because
they're the most successful.
So that mentality, ironically, it's anti. I mean, it's actually a radical liberal position. It's anti-elitist because the way free markets work is the more people you sell to. So I'm very critical of the left, but at least their ideology is somewhat consistent. Conservatism is just based on so many contradictions because. Yeah, that's a very anti-elitist position because it's not how it works. And one thing about Yang, that Yang has been saying that I really, that's really important, is he does talk about what we're saying about bullshit jobs, basically the culture where one's economic output determines one's worth in society. And he was talking about the whole, like, the massive rise in suicide rates are basically caused by that because a lot of people are becoming economically obsolete, and basically they see no self-worth for themselves of value in society. So what Yang's talking about, this whole concept of human-centered capitalism, so we have to measure the success of our economy and other factors other than GDP, so basically things like social mobility, social capital, mental health.
Yeah, and also I mentioned this to someone on Twitter, but with like universal basic income, like you're more free to move around and live where you want. Like I can't even think of all of the times where I've like been miserable just because I couldn't move because I was trapped in some job, and like if you move to a new city, you got to make sure you have a job there and like a department and all of that. So it's like it would be nice if you just had that and you could say like, well, I could move to this town, even if prices inflate or something because everyone's getting this money. Like, you can always move from like Los Angeles to Boise or something like that, and then you could still, you know what I mean, like you could move to it. It might actually cause like a revitalization of smaller towns because people don't live there because there's no work. But if you could live in a small town and still sustain yourself, maybe more people would do that with mm-hmm. with this extra money. Anatoly Karlin was the one who made that point. I thought it was really interesting.
There's no telling, you know, what some of the effects of this could be, and obviously there are some concerns people have about what a UBI would do, but I think I'm way more inclined to think that it could lead to a cultural renewal and renaissance of in a variety of different ways, some of which might even surprise us.
Yeah, it will. It could very well lead to a massive decentralization of the economy and revitalization of small towns, because there's all these places. Just in California, there's these small farming towns where they have potential to build a more kind of cohesive community, but people don't live there because there's no jobs, or they could basically become
there's no prospects.
Yeah, so become kind of like the new kind of artist colonies and stuff like that. And I guess another thing about this whole basic income and the conservative mentality, yeah, so conservatives are assuming that everyone's just going to be lazy and watch TV, but I really think that's they're projecting what they would do.
Yeah, I think there's something to that. I mean, I think there's, I wish I had the studies at my fingertips, but I've talked to smart kind of libertarian types about UBI. Back in college, I knew some pretty educated people on it, and I remember someone citing a study that, showed that people actually are not, like if they're given a certain amount of money, they actually spend it, wisely, and like basically that people, if given the resources, will make rational decisions.
Well, and also in this case, remember, everyone is getting it. So it's kind of skewed when you take a situation where like only a certain segment of the population is getting it, because like those people may already be making poor decisions to be in that situation. You know what I mean? So it's like if everybody's getting it, then people are going to react to it differently. You know what I mean? So it's like,
yeah, the whole psychology of this is a little bit different than like welfare.
Right, because you're comparing apples to oranges. like, or even just like unemployment insurance or something like that. Like it's the motivations for people getting it are not going to be all the same. If it goes to everyone, you're going to be dealing with completely different, all kinds of completely different kinds of people. Of course, there are going to be people who like squander it, and I mean, it doesn't end up being useful for them, or they spend it on drugs or something like that. But you know, that's not, it's not going to be like that for across the board.
There is a lot of former Trump voters now supporting Yang. And yeah, that's what I think about is remarkable about his candidacy, because we've talked about this idea of quite some time of a kind of fusion or alliance between the dissident right and dissident left. And there's never been a candidate who had support from both those groups I can think of, because, I mean, there was the Bernie Sanders Trump voters who voted for Bernie in the primary, but those are two different candidates, and they never, like, those two movements never really associated. So this is the first time in modern history or recent history that I can think of where you have one campaign which has basically a lot of people from the left, primarily a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters, some Trump supporters, some libertarians. So basically everyone on the dissident right is now turned against Trump. So basically, ironically, the only people who still support Trump now are the people who opposed him in the primary, like the people who voted for Ted Cruz, Jeb Bush, or Marco Rubio. All of Trump's original supporters.
Yeah, that's Trump's base now. That's Trump's base now. Like,
and Ann Coulter, basically, she came out against Trump. Lou Dobbs said something very critical of him. Basically, I mean, as the alt-right goes, Richard Spencer has been against him a long time. But
yeah.
Now the alt-right types are now
what is
against Trump.
Though, what is interesting, though, is that what Yang has managed to do is what something that like that no one could ever do, and he's actually managed to unite all of these like former factions of the alt-right that hate each other. Like, can you imagine, like, Greg Johnson is posting like Yang Gang stuff, Richard Spencer, and like all of the irony bros, like that, those people, you know, the people who had been the Daily Stormer, but remember, all of these people fucking hate each other. You know,
yeah.
And they are all on board with Yang Gang. Even Nick Fuentes, I think, came out for supporting Yang now, and that's like
it's absolutely everyone. Yeah.
The only people that are the holdouts are just like the most like kind of surly, like just the kind of old school like Stormfront people that just have like absolute humorless assholes.
Well, you know, I have seen a few things. I gather we will be talking about immigration at some point, because I have this Twitter account, Identitarian Quotes, put a bunch of stuff about how, you know, Yang's immigration policy. Steve Saylor, maybe Steve Saylor said something about Tulsi, I don't remember. I mean, there are some people who still will criticize his stance on immigration and haven't been won over in that sense. But definitely your broader point is absolutely like the overall unity.
Well, yeah, it's primarily a generation divide. So basically everyone under 40 is no longer supporting Trump. It's only the really older people who are backing Trump.
Except for me, I'm 40 on the dot.
Oh right, yeah,
right on the cusp.
As far as Trump goes, like the primary reason that people supported Trump was immigration, but also expanding the Overton window on political correctness. And what's basically happened is Trump's came out in favor of massively increasing legal immigration, has done very little about illegal immigration, and as far as political correctness, stuff like deplatforming has gotten far worse under Trump than it would have been under a Democrat, is my assessment.
I still appreciate the way that Trump did expand the Overton window, but I think it's kind of served its purpose. I don't think there's that much good that's coming out of that anymore.
So basically there's no reason to support Trump, and the thing about Yang is obviously pro-immigration, but he has a whole bunch of other issues that can appeal to dissidents. Trump basically Trump's policies is this is my one issue and everything else, I'm just like a generic Republican. But the thing is, like, it's a whole bunch of issues.
Well, yeah, and the thing with Yang is, it's like, and these people who bring up, like, his immigration policy, or, like, the, I think even on, like, you know, Mike Enoch or someone was like, oh, we need to go to these rallies and try to get Yang to tweak his positions on immigration. Like, that's just, like, they just don't get it, really. Like, there's not, it doesn't really matter what Yang's position on immigration and all this other stuff is, because it's over. There's no like viable electoral pathway towards restricting immigration or visas or anything like that. Like, there's like Trump had a chance to do some of that and he blew it, and there's nobody proposing that kind of stuff for the foreseeable future. So when these people get out there and they're like, well, look at his position on immigration, it's like, well, it doesn't matter, because it's like, it's too late to do anything about any of that stuff. So like, all we can do is just try this weird experimental shit and try
basically the mentality of support for Yang, basically accepting that America, it's too late to save America, so I'm just going to enjoy my 1,000, my neat bucks.
Yeah, there's like an accelerationist aspect to it. And I did want to say, Richard Spencer, who can be very just put things in a very intelligent and succinct way, has that gift, obviously, posted on Twitter about, you know, how basically Trumpism is clinging to an old ideal of America and believing it can be brought back, whereas Yangism, or the Yang pill, I mean, he didn't say that, that's my words, is the recognition that you can't, you know, bring that old America back, and it's a bold kind of step into the future.
I saw the same tweet,
and yeah, basically Yangism is a recognition that, like, the America we know and love is over, and so we got to step into this brave new thing and try to maneuver something interesting out of it. Like, but the old stuff of, like, oh, we're gonna use tariffs and we're gonna stop mass immigration from the third world. Like, there's really, it seems like there's no possible way to implement that, and there's no one even close to the levers of power who could actually do anything about that. So it, like, you know, it doesn't matter what the fuck Yang's position on immigration, because it's like, okay, well, you point to me the guy who is you know, point to me, like, the pro-white candidate who's going to, like, restore 1950s America and, like, completely like evict everyone from California and New York and Florida and all of these, like, hundreds of millions of people. Like, there's nobody promising to do that. So it's like, you're going to have to find a way to, you know, to worm your way into the system and like these other people do. And like I said, even if all Yang does is follow through on his promise to, like, ban robocalls and you know, sign the American Mall Act to preserve and repurpose these structures, like, that alone would be more than Trump ever did for me. And if for $1,000 a month, if he could get that, I mean, that would allow me fucking total escapism from normies, and I would, you know, I would be shut in lifestyle, you know, and just, like, you know, living it up. Like,
yeah, that's the other thing about Nate Bucks, is working a job forces you to conform to society, and I think with the basic income, it enables escapism, but also enables people to form their own small subcultures, which are completely removed from mainstream society. So in a sense, that basically, I mean, that is a genuine freedom that you want, not the kind of freedom that conservatives say. It's freedom about freedom as having a job and making your money.
Yeah,
right,
and
because
I think
everyone assumes that, like, $1,000 a month is just, like, it's just an individual for you, but like imagine like if a bunch of like-minded people took their 1,000 a month and formed their own weird kind of little sub area that they all lived off. It's not just about like what you do with 1,000 a month. Like, what if you get like a whole house full of people and you have, you know, you got like 15,000 a month for, you're all renting out this house and you turn it into this, I don't know, you turn it into this fucking neat factory paradise.
Yeah.
It's kind of like it's not just about the individual like me getting $1,000 and like going to Steinmart and buying a bunch of sunglasses and shit, you know?
Yeah, so some people are concerned that the basic income will make society more socially atomized, which
I kind of think it would.
That could happen with people just living in these small cubicle apartments, like micro apartments, and playing video games all day and eating junk food. And that's definitely likely, but there could also be these kind of like neo-tribal enclaves. So it's really
kind of where the accelerationism comes in, because it's like it's taking us to a further point, perhaps, within neoliberalism, whatever you want to call it. But it takes us to a point where then something completely new, given the technological advances and societal progressions that we've had. It takes all that stuff, which a lot of it's been bad, but it takes all that stuff, brings us to a certain end point with it, and then something new can be built on top of that, is kind of the way I see it.
As far as the whole debate about immigration goes, as far as restricting immigration, I think basically Trump proved that restricting immigration on the grounds of like Americanism or American identity, I mean, that's not going to happen. But I do think what will happen is that basically the economy based on labor is based on on endless supplies of cheap labor. But when most people have a basic income, they're not going to want to share their basic income with like millions of people coming in from Central America. So basically it will make it so people will look at immigration on a practical basis rather than a basis on we have to save America.
Right, rather than look at, it's going to have people might potentially, I mean, not necessarily because most people are pretty dumb and not very logical, but a lot of people will look and if bringing in masses of people from like Somalia or something means that like suddenly they're going to stop getting their $1,000 check every month. Like, well, then they might actually give a shit, you know, kind of like people with their social security, you know, it's like the minute that you start talking about that, like they just like, you know, they go ape shit. So that, that is a possibility. Not saying that, because I don't want to make the full argument that I think like, well, you know, maybe, you know, people will care about immigration like once this happens, because it seems like most people are just like, they're just too stupid to really give a shit, you know, but I would rather not even like try to make that prediction. But I do think that Trump made a very serious flaw, I think, or, you know, maybe it wasn't even a flaw, maybe he just like, you know, maybe he's just a complete charlatan, but what he did, where he made the biggest error, was that he filled his administration with people that didn't agree with the ideas that he ran on, and then the few people that he did get in his administration, like Bannon and Sessions and stuff, that were actually like kind of understood the issues and were like on the same page, like he totally chucked them under the bus. You know, he trashed them, and so you can't really empathize with the guy when he says, well, I'm trying to do all this stuff and I'm getting thwarted by the system. Like, well, he had the opportunity to like appoint like a fuck ton of like nationalists and all kinds of different people to his administration, and like 90% of the people with brains that he appointed, like he dumped them, and then he appointed people like a Secretary of State that didn't even agree with his own foreign policy. Like,
yeah.
So you have to just wonder, like, you know, he can't make the excuse that, like, I've been trying to do all this stuff and I've been thwarted by the system, because to the extent that he had the ability to utilize the system and have some control over it, he completely squandered what was in his control.
Yeah, he's really kind of blowing it right now, I think. I don't know if either of you are, like, signed up for his mailing list, but all he talks about these days is, like, the Democratic platform, how America will never be socialist. Like he's really become – he's on the defensive, and it's not a good look.
Yeah, everything about Trump is just saying we're never – America's never going to be a socialist nation, and yeah, all that
and
stuff.
You know, and that's all new. He never – like, I'm not a socialist either, but he, you know, so I'm not saying that that alone I'm attacking him on. But, you know, he never, as far as I remember, he never really talked about socialism or anything like that. There was a refreshing aspect of his campaign in 2016. He wasn't all about free markets. He wasn't, you know, he actually said some things about, you know, Bernie Sanders over Clinton, as I recall. And he really is kind of turning into this mainstream.
Yeah, I would be okay with supporting Trump if he lived up to his original campaign platform. But that's obviously, but that happens pretty much with every major candidate.
I would have, even if he just said like a piece of it, because like really the only good thing about his presidency was the making peace with North Korea, and he even like blew that because he got like Bolton and all these people involved, and suddenly they're, you know, demanding North Korea get rid of their nukes and stuff, and of course like he was never going to agree to do that, like after all of the times that the U.S. has like done these regime change wars, like why would anyone be stupid enough to like give up their defense?
So with Yang, I think as far as all those alt-right types goes, the initial support was when Yang tweeted basically about America becoming majority minority by 2045, and he says that this will be a truly dangerous time, particularly as well as decimating the most common middle-class jobs. Economic stress adds to social polarization and violence. And basically what Yang was doing is, he wasn't saying that America becoming majority-minority was inherently bad, but he wasn't cheering it on like the left usually does. He just says that it's going to create a lot of difficult challenges for this nation. And then another tweet was on white demographic decline, including low birth rates and also the rising suicide rate among white men. And that got a lot of attention. Well, he was on Tucker Carlson. And on Joe Rogan show, he basically said that among the left that the suffering of white men is often diminished. So basically, Yang's message is not... It's basically race neutral. He basically rejects...
It's race neutral.
Identity politics.
Well, I think... What Yang was really getting at, I think, with that is, like, instead of, like, cheering on this demographic decline, what he was doing is he's recognizing, he's saying, like, whites are going to be a minority by this time. So he understands that that's going to, breed a lot of, like, resentment and conflict, and that we need to find a way to, like, to address this and placate these people so that doesn't happen.
And another
he's simply saying like that these things that, you know, he doesn't use the term, but these things that the alt-right talks about, like they're real issues, which even Trump has not, you know, stated that explicitly. So it really is pretty
big.
Yeah,
I don't think I've heard Trump ever say the word white. He just says he just talks about things in terms of Americanism. And also I think in a future that is more kind of neo-tribalist, we will have to talk more openly about these issues. I'm not talking about in an alt-right or white nationalist sense, but in a more pragmatic sense that in a kind of society, I think thinking more in the sense of how do you make a multi-ethnic, multicultural nation work, we will have to talk openly, openly about these issues. And
right, you're going to have a recognition that, like, there are... like that whites represent a group that is going to have some kind of interest also, like you're just going to have to deal with that and find a way to, rather than the way we currently like deal with all this stuff is just, it's all swept under the rug kind of. And, it festers, you know, so you'd have to actually talk openly about like, here's how we're going to have to deal with this issue.
And as far as the Neat issue goes, it seems like Yang is directly trying to appeal to Neats because, basically, obviously, now they're, well, the basic income is called Neat Bucks, obviously, and, Yang tweeted the article on the sex recession, and he said more young men are living with parents than romantic partners, and Anatoly Karlin tweeted that Yang is explicitly the candidate for high IQ Neat, so, yeah, basically... It's basically Neat nationalism.
Or is it nationalism? I don't know. It's, well,
it's
Neat something.
It's post-nationalism, I think. It's
yeah,
like, it's,
yeah.
It's Neat internationalism. Like.
Yeah, post-nationalism is a good word.
So at a recent Q&A, Andrew Yang was asked what should be done to stop censorship and deplatforming on social media. And basically, he said that these companies should be classified as a public utility, allowing them to be regulated to protect freedom of speech. And this is obviously very important, but the people who care about this issue are disproportionately more on the right. So I think he is really doing this to kind of get that crossover appeal, and it's a really important issue. It's also important to point out that conservatives would never do this because they have this idiotic ideology about letting the free market do whatever they want.
Right, like, oh, these are private businesses. They can do whatever they want, which only makes sense up to a certain point when they have a complete monopoly. And in many cases, some of these, like, corporations, these tech companies have are more powerful than the government in terms of, like, speech and getting the word, because I mean, even if you could post whatever you wanted to on some government website or something like that, I mean, that would still that's still nothing compared to what Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, the reach that these kind of sites have.
So Yang is supporting the Mall Act, and this would invest in decaying in malls and all these malls that are sitting empty. Because basically, if a mall declines, it leads to crime, economic decay, all sorts of problems, and it's really important to revitalize these places. And another thing about Yang is he has a position on zoning, and he talks about the whole issue with NIMBYs restricting housing, because that's a huge issue in major urban areas, is that housing densities are restricted, and that pushes out a lot of middle-class people. So that's a huge issue, and he's the first major presidential candidate to address zoning and the whole housing crisis. And as Brandon, you have a personal fascination and passion for malls. So what's your interest in the Mall Act? He's now actually being called, like, because of this, like the vaporwave candidate.
Yeah, well, I think that what appeals to me about it is that he actually, like, recognizes that that these structures shouldn't just be, like, left sitting there to rot or, like, demolished, that they actually have, like, a community purpose, and that they could be, like, repurposed for something else, so that they will still have the kind of utility they had in terms of the fostering community and things like that, which most people don't think about, like the mall as being that. It's like a place to shop, but
because malls.
One big difference between, I think, like my generation and like later generations is that, like, when we were teenagers and stuff, like we went to the mall, like we might have been like going to the arcade or something like that, but you would actually, like, you know, you would meet people there. Like, it was used to be a thing. Like, we would go to the mall and try to meet some girls or something like that. And I think that one of the reasons why younger people are so socially retarded is because they don't really have that. And it's like, when I was a kid, like, you actually had to, like, you had to work to make friends. Like, you couldn't just, like, go online and just, like, start chatting with random weirdos or something like that, like, on a network. Like, you actually had to go in person and, like, get out of the house and actually like work to meet someone like in person. And I think that that's like people underestimate just how psychologically important that is, because you see all of these like millennials and Generation Z that they get into like these work situations and they're just completely socially retarded and they can't handle like, you know what I mean? They just have constant like anxiety over the most basic shit, you know, like someone saying hello to them or something like it. Just the most basic shit. Like I was just always like working for like social media companies and things like that. I was always just amazed at like the bizarre, like social retardation of some of these people that they just like, and they've really never been socialized. It's just like if you take a dog to the dog park that has like never been out of the house and he's gonna act like all fucked up compared to you know, dogs that are like well socialized.
People are gonna continue to use the internet, and that's not going to change. But I think the only thing we can do about that, about social atomization, I think one thing we can do is restructure our urban planning model. So I think back in the 80s and 90s, and I even remember this as a kid, a lot of older people were dismissing malls as basically as a consumerist. But it was basically, they kind of served as like the equivalent of the town squares, places where people would go to meet. And in a lot of suburban areas today, like there's absolutely nothing.
Or you will go to go to like Walmart or something, but even those places are in trouble too.
You don't really go to Walmart or even a more like an upscale store. You just go there for utilitarian purposes to buy something and then you just leave.
Yeah, it's not really. But the whole point with the mall is that it actually has an aesthetic. I mean, it's a very capitalist aesthetic, and people didn't take it very seriously from a cultural perspective in the 80s and 90s, but now that they're closing, it's plain that something is lost there, that these are aesthetically
exactly
interesting. Yeah, and Yang gets that, which, for me too, as a fan of malls, really hits me emotionally.
Yeah, and I think also a lot of it has to
Yang
do with...
Yang is actually, he's only 36 years old, so he's probably had, like...
I think he's about your age. He was born in 75, so, yeah, he's a Gen Xer. He grew up in the 80s and 90s, so, he gets that.
So he would have had the same experience where, like, he probably recognizes... I don't want to say how great that was, but that he clearly has some nostalgia for that the way that I do, and I think he understands it.
Yeah, I think there is a lot of potential in revitalizing these malls, because a lot of these suburban areas, they don't have an authentic or traditional downtown area. But if you take a mall and you retrofit it, they're destroying the original aesthetics, but ideally I'd like to see those aesthetics, or at least some of them, get preserved. I know like a couple of them that we like, West Side Pavilion in LA is being transformed into Google. Horton Plaza is being transformed into some planned tech campus. And a lot of those kind of 80s postmodernist architecture, it sort of pays homage to these aesthetics of the past. So I think there's a lot of potential for these areas becoming like town centers for suburbs that lack that. Basically, what I want to say about Yang is because he's thinking of new ideas, innovative ideas for the future. Both a lot of these older candidates, including the establishment candidates like Kamala Harris, Bernie Sanders, Donald Trump, they're all trying to regurgitate these failed ideas and policies of the later part of the 20th century. Yang is the only
boomer
candidate.
Crap. Yeah, exactly.
Well, Yang is the only candidate who has like forward-thinking solutions.
I would say that. Just in conclusion, on my part, I'd say that these other candidates are all completely. They're still entrenched in these like 20th century political ideological paradigms. Where I think Yang is moving closer to the newer paradigms that have broken up all of those, and that's where you see like support for him, like among both like the irony left and the irony right, and all of these different factions of people that, you know, this, the other candidates living in this, like this 1980s, 1990s, you know, of like socialism versus capitalism and war versus peace and things like that. It, you know what I mean? It's like,
yeah,
interventionism,
absolutely.
And not, it's, there's like,
it's all...
Yang is getting closer to what the newer paradigms are. They're not going to be the same as this old stuff that, this boomer era, paradigm of liberal and conservative. Like, you don't even hear people use those terms really, unless they're old people. Nobody says like liberals or conservatives. It's either like nationalists or like Antifa,
yeah,
or
and that's,
accelerationists.
That's,
like,
you can tell where Trump really, when basically the major change of Trump is when he changed his rhetoric. Instead of saying things like nationalism, he said conservative versus liberal. I mean, that was a real turning point. Before I wrap up the show, Matt, do you want anything?
Yeah, I just kind of want to echo what Brandon said just now. I mean, I think the social reality we're living in and the shifting paradigms are that so much has changed so quickly with technology and will continue to change so quickly with technology and things like mass immigration and just you know, there is a things that keeps accelerating. And I think that Andrew Yang is the only candidate who's actually looking at the facts of this and is actually, you know, he's a young enough guy. He understands the kind of younger generation and the ways that things are changing. And not only do I think his ideas are good, I think he's the only candidate who's really talking about some of these issues.
We are at the end of the show. Thanks, guys, for being on. And it will really be interesting to see where what will happen with this election.
He's going to win.
Yeah, we got to make it happen, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been a great show, guys. Thanks,
guys.